Welcome. This is the Fly Fishing Journeys podcast with host Rob Giannino, where we have great conversation with really awesome experts from within the fly fishing community. You see, the fly fishing lifestyle is a journey, and we're glad you're on this journey with us. Check out flyfishingjourneys.com for more podcasts, journal-style blog posts, and a link to our social media community. And please subscribe on your favorite podcast player. Here's your host, Rob Giannino.
Thanks, Josh.
I'm honored to be with legendary fly fisherman and author Gary Borger. Gary is known throughout the industry as an expert in all aspects of fly fishing, including casting, reading the water, matching the hatch, flies, patterns, and materials. He's the author of 11 books, including a beautiful white hardcover series called Fly Fishing, a book series which currently has 5 volumes and will eventually have 20. He was chosen to submit a fly to America's Favorite Fly book collaboration, which we'll talk about. And you'll see him at the fly fishing shows where he serves as an exhibit cast instructor. Gary, thank you for being with me today.
My pleasure, Rob.
So let me ask you, you grew up in Wisconsin?
No, I actually grew up in western Pennsylvania, about halfway between Pittsburgh and Erie, near the cities of Franklin and Oil City.
Wow. Okay, well, I have a good friend, Scott Grassi, who owns the Steelhead Inn in Erie, Pennsylvania.
Oh, nice.
And yeah, we've been fishing the Tribs quite frequently recently.
Sure, excellent fishing up there.
And I'm sure you fished the Tribs for Steelhead growing up. And
yep. Lots of good fishing in that country. The streams I focused on were those right in the area where we lived, which would have included French Creek, the Upper Allegheny River, Sugar Creek, and several smaller streams in that area, like 16 Mile and several others, all of which were very good trout streams. In fact, Sugar Creek is still considered one of Pennsylvania's premier trout streams.
What did you like about fishing in that western Pennsylvania area?
Well, number one, I grew up there, so there wasn't much to like or dislike. You just did what you did in those days. We were very fortunate in the fact that we lived close to Sugar Creek because it was an excellent trout stream. And like I said, still considered to be one of the premier trout streams in Pennsylvania. It's extremely clean water, too, also. And there were lots of things that we could do as kids growing up there because we had horses and we could ride wherever we wanted to ride and we could walk wherever we wanted to walk. And we were within a quarter of a mile of the trout streams. So it was very easy to access those and be able to fish anytime we wanted, day or night, you know, summer, winter, fall, didn't matter when. Anytime we've got the urge to fish, we'd fish. And so basically we just grew up, you know, wild doing whatever we wanted to do. And I fished a tremendous amount when I was a kid. Wish I could fish that much now. It's one of those kind of things.
How did you actually get started fly fishing?
I started fly fishing when I was 11. I'd been fishing before that since I was about 4. But I started fly fishing when I was 11 because I'd been reading in my father's outdoor magazines like Field and Stream and Outdoor Life and other magazines like that about trout fishing. And people like Ted Trueblood and Joe Brooks and then very young Ernie Schwiebert and others had written lots of articles about fly fishing and about all the excitement of it. It just sounded, I don't know, romantic to me. I don't know. It sounded great. So I asked for a fly tying kit for my 11th Christmas, and I got one, and I started tying flies, and oh, they were ugly compared to what I could do now. Right. I wish I'd saved some of them, but hooks were too valuable in those days, so we'd tie flies and cut them apart and tie them again, just as practice. I started when I was 11 and have continued on, obviously, ever since. One of the things that intrigued me about it was the problem solving involved. There's a lot of problem solving involved in it, especially when you're young and you're used to catching fish on worms and a piece of split shot and your flies won't sink.
Mm-hmm. You know?
So I started fishing split shot when I was probably 12 years old, 11, 12 years old, on my flies simply because I couldn't get them down any other way.
Mm.
So I've been doing that nymphing process ever since then, at a very early age.
Now, how did I hear, did you eventually move to Wisconsin or?
Yeah, I got my bachelor's and master's degree at Penn State University.
Mm.
And then in those years, you were not allowed to get a PhD at the same university where you got a bachelor's or master's. And so I had to go someplace else. And my focus was physiology and anatomy of trees. And so the two people that were the best in the United States, one was in Duke, and then the other one was in Wisconsin. In fact, the guy that was in Duke was the professor of the guy that was in Wisconsin. And the guy that was in Wisconsin was considered at that time the world's foremost tree physiologist. So I was very fortunate to be accepted into his program and go there. My degree is in forestry and botany, and my focus is in anatomy and physiology of plants. And then from there, of course, I taught at the University of Wisconsin up in Wausau, a two-year campus, and our students then would go to Madison, basically all of them went to Madison. And I taught 5-credit botany, 3-credit botany, a couple sections of zoology lab. I taught writing in the sciences, natural history of photography, and tree identification, along with a few other things occasionally. Mm. Those were the ones I focused on.
Yeah, because I thought I read in one of your materials that you considered Wisconsin your home water, so that's why.
Right. So yeah, I did a lot of fishing in Wisconsin because we lived there, but we traveled all over the world. And it's interesting, in 1973, the Fenwick Rod Company decided they were going to have national fly fishing schools. They're the first ones to ever do that. And so they had, Mel Krieger was the director of the West Coast. Frank Gray was a director, was a good friend of Jim Green, who was then a rod designer at Fenwick, did the Rocky Mountains. They hired me at the age of 29 to be the director of the Midwest fly fishing schools, and then Jim Guilford did the East. And it was that process that sort of launched me into all these other things. I'd already started writing for magazines, but when that happened, because it was a fly fishing school and nobody had ever done it before, a lot of people from sporting goods stores and clubs would come there and go through the school. And then, of course, they'd say, well, do you do this, or do you come and speak at clubs? And, of course, immediately I said, well, of course I do, whether I did or not. And I'd put the stuff together and go do it. Right. So that sort of launched that career. And then, in the meantime, I was also writing and did that. And then I started doing shows and other kinds of things from all that.
Well, let's talk briefly about your famous son, Jason.
Right.
Now, obviously, he's well known for being the shadow caster
on
Rivers Run Through It. Stood in for Brad Pitt for all those famous scenes in Montana at the end of the movie. Tell us, I mean, I think so many dads want to know how you introduced Jason to fly fishing, because I think as a dad myself, you want him enjoying himself, you want him catching fish, maybe you'll start him with a spinning rod. And how do you make that process of introducing your son or daughter into the sport of fly fishing? And maybe we can relate to how you did that with Jason.
Sure. Jason caught his first fish by himself at the age of 2.5.
Wow.
And he did that with my 7.5-foot, 5-weight Fenwick glass rod at the time and a red-brown nymph that I had devised. And we were fishing in Montana. We'd gone to Montana. And before he caught his first fish, we were fishing on several different streams, and I would let him play the fish. I would tell him, when the fish pulls, you let go of the reel handle, and when the fish stops, you crank. And he would land fish and have a really good time doing that. And then we were fishing on a little creek called Squaw Creek, which was only about 1 mile from where he actually did the casting off the rock when he did the shadow cast for the movie.
Right.
It was only 1 mile from there.
Unbelievable.
So, unbelievable circle that he completed.
That is phenomenal.
Anyway, so we were walking up the stream, and he was with me, and I saw a fish flash. And it's a small stream. And I said, Jason, cast out there. And he just grabbed the rod with 2 hands and threw it out. And I yelled, you've got him, Jason, you've got him. And, of course, he pitched it up in the bushes behind him. It turned out it was a 13-inch rainbow. And, of course, when that happens, I mean, you're in for life. I mean, that's all there is to it. But what we would do after that is we would take Jason fishing for bluegills. Number one, don't make your kid learn how to cast. All right? Just let them get the fly out there any way they can. If they have to use 2 hands on the rod, let them use 2 hands on the rod. Who cares? They're catching fish and having a good time. Number two, if they prefer to throw rocks rather than fish, let them throw rocks. The idea is to get them out there with you in the out-of-doors, enjoying life and doing something with your parent, with their parents. And they'll go where they need to go. Maybe they'll take up golf later on, but they'll always appreciate the time you spent with them as a child doing those kinds of things. And that's what you're trying to do. You're not really trying to create a fly fisher. You're trying to create somebody that's bonded to you and family.
That's just wonderful.
And one of the things that I did when Jason was born, I didn't run out and buy him a fly rod. Number one, I didn't have any money because I was in graduate school. Number two, I decided that if Jason didn't want to fly fish, Jason wasn't going to fly fish. If Jason preferred art and riding bicycles, Jason could have art and ride bicycles. Because our job as parents is not to take a child and turn them into an imperfect us. Our job is to take a child with a blank slate and let them write on it the things that they need for their lives to become everything that they're intended to become.
That's awesome.
And that's the way we should raise our children, and that's the way we raise Jason. But he just automatically, I mean, even before I took him fly fishing when he was still only, I mean, not even 2 years old, he was down in the basement wanting to tie flies just because he wanted to be involved in what we were doing. And so you don't try to make him tie perfect flies. You break the barb off, break the bend off a hook and clamp it in the vise. And if he wants to use a tie on a whole peacock feather, let him tie on a whole peacock feather. He's just doing something that's creative and for his brain, and he wants to do what dad or mom's doing.
That's fun.
And that's the way you need to do it. And it works very well. And he started with a fly rod and never touched a spinning rod in his life. The interesting thing is because I became the director of the Fenwick Fly Fishing Schools, of course, he went to all the schools because my wife Nancy is also an excellent fly fisher, and she taught in the schools with me. So when 1975, we got the opportunity to do fly fishing schools for Fenwick at a big ranch in New Mexico called Vermejo Park. Vermejo, 600,000 acres. Just this vast, vast area. It's all wild. The only people that are on there are the guests of the ranch. It's a dude ranch kind of thing, but it has lots of fly fishing. So when he was five, we'd stand him in the back of the boat and he'd catch 18 to 22 inch fish all day long. So wow. He got all the skills developed. By the time he was 14, he could cast as well as anyone. In fact, when he was 12, when he was 11, he won the Federation of Fly Fishers Youth Casting Championship. When he was 12, he won it, and when he was 13, he won it. And because he won it every year, it looked like he'd win it from every year thereon, they've made a special gift just for him, a special present, a fly rod and a reel and line and a big plaque and all that kind of stuff that they presented to him and said, you can't ever cast in our youth casting competitions again because, there's nobody else going to have a chance. So they gave him a special lifetime award, a youth award.
Wow.
Well, then when he was 16, he won the Adult Coleander Cup. So he's been casting for, not only that, did he have the advantage of having me as a father to teach him to cast, but I know everybody in fly fishing. And of course, I knew all the other instructors. And of course, all the instructors also knew everybody else. And Jim Green, who was the rod designer at Fenwick, was also a youth casting championship when he was 17 and the first guy ever to cast a fly over 200 feet. And so he had the advantage of knowing Jim Green. Mm-hmm. So he had all these tips and hints coming in from people like Ernie Schwiebert, like Dave Whitlock, like Lefty Cray, like Jim Green, like everybody in fly fishing. And so his ability and his understanding of casting just grew immensely. I always tell people, they say, your son casts so well. I said, well, if you're going to have an Olympic skier, do you start them skiing when they're 17?
Mm-hmm.
No, you start them before they can walk.
Right.
And Jason started when he was 2.5. And just grew into it because he wanted to, not because I forced him to, because he wanted to. And as a consequence, he was able to learn large amounts because he wanted to possess that for himself as his own, as his own right in fishing. And as a consequence, he's become a superb caster. Now, most people, when they watch me cast, say, oh my gosh, can you cast? I said, you should see Jason cast. He's probably in the upper 3% in the world in terms of his understanding of casting and his ability to do it.
And now he's writing and he's painting and drawing.
Yeah.
He's got some incredible drawings in your books here. It looks like he does all the illustrations for your series.
Yes, he does. And he just published a new book called Single Hand Fly Casting, in which there are over 400 illustrations, hand-drawn illustrations, all made from high-speed photography of his actual casting. So what you see in the illustration is actually him in the actual way he actually casts. Not, well, this is, I think, how I do it. No, it's actually the way he does do it.
And what's the name of that book again?
It's called Single Hand Fly Casting.
Okay.
It was just published. It's available, when you come to these shows, it's available through the Angling Bookstore. It's also available on his blog, which is just jasonborger.com.
And we'll go ahead and put that in the show notes as well.
Excellent.
So our listeners can grab that information. Well, that's awesome, and you're obviously very proud. You should be an incredible young man, and I guess would be a man now. He's married.
Yeah.
And
he's 48, believe it
or
not.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and he has two kids, two great-grandchildren. One is 5 and one is 1. And the 5-year-old is Brooke, and she is really excited to fish. She keeps asking me, Gee, Pops, why don't you take me fishing for tarpon? Can we go fish for piranha? Can we go catch piata? Can I catch a big rainbow trout? I want to get her one that's as big as I am.
So she's got a big bucket list.
It's a she's full already list. There. Yeah.
That's great. Gary, you've also contributed to this great new coffee table style book, America's Favorite Flies. Over 600 pages, 224 contributors, including flies, artwork, and stories. You contributed the Griffith's Gnat?
I contributed the Griffith's Gnat.
Now, first of all, tell us, what did you think of the book? Have you seen the publication?
Oh, sure, I've seen it, of course. It's a great publication, and they did a very good job printing it and publishing it and collecting the information. And the people that wrote for it all did something that I consider to be of value in terms of not just lessons on how to fly fish, but the whole concept of fly fishing and the way people conceive fly fishing itself and the way you can see how individuals all have different kinds of ideas and thoughts about what fly fishing means to them. Somebody's asked, what does fly fishing mean to you? Well, it means something different to everybody. Each person is in it for a different reason. I'm in it because I like problem solving, and because I like fish, and because I like to tackle, and because I sort of grew up doing it. Other people are in it for other reasons. So it's interesting to read about the flies that they selected and why they selected it. You know, one person will select it because they're a saltwater fisherman, they catch more bonefish on that fly than any other fly. Somebody else is a trout fisherman, and they've always used this fly, and they grew up, and their dad tied it for them, et cetera, et cetera. So there's different reasons for choices. I picked a Griffith's Gnat for several different reasons. One is that it's just a very good all-around fly anytime there's midge hatches on. And I've used it all over the world and caught fish in it every place I've ever fished. So New Zealand, you know, I've caught it. I caught them in England. I've caught them in France. I've caught them in Russia. I've caught them in, let's see, where else am I? Overseas. I've caught them in South America. I've caught them across all of North America, Tasmania, which is Australia, and other. I mean, every place I fish, I use that fly, simply because more than 50% of the species of insects in any freshwater system are midges. So they're always around, and they'll hatch any time that there's not ice on the water. So it's a superb fly. In addition to that, I knew George Griffith personally, and I did a video called Fishing the Midge, in which we interviewed George on the origin of the fly and how it came about and all that sort of thing. And the whole thing is just very interesting. And when Jason was young, that was one of his favorite flies. And he and I have fished that together for a lot of years. And so there's sort of a history of the fly in my fishing that's interesting. I catch fish on all kinds of things, not just a Griffith's Gnat. But I picked it for that particular reason, because it has sort of a personal history with me and knowing George and other kinds of things. And knowing
a symbiotic relationship.
Yeah, knowing the history of the fly and how it evolved, and the fact that I've just caught tons of fish on it all over the world.
Well, I'm just so impressed with the book, and you can get lost in that book.
I mean,
you can just read and read, and you can start here and end up there, and it's a beautiful book. It's almost 7 pounds.
Yeah, it's a big book.
It's a big book, and it's for a great cause.
It is. The profits are actually donated to a native fish organization and a salmon reclamation project. I can't remember which one it is right off the top of my head.
The James River.
James River, there you go.
James River Association. Yep. And just a great program. So you must have been honored to be part of that collaboration.
I was. Very happy to do something like that. It's always nice to give back to your sport, and when you can give back in a way that at the same time gives some history about your own personal life. Because people are always asking things about, you know, how did you get into fly fishing? And, you know, it's nice to be able to give something back that helps people understand better who you are, and maybe will help them in their formation as a fly fisher also.
So Gary, as I look through your blog, I see you've had many great trips with Chuck Ferimsky, who's the founder of the Fly Fishing Show.
Tell us about friendships in fly fishing.
Now that's interesting. Chuck and I met in about 1993 or maybe 92 at the fly fishing show that the Michigan Fly Fishers put on in Detroit. And Chuck at that time was thinking about doing something like that. At that time he owned a leather store at Seven Springs Resort here in Pennsylvania. And he wanted to do something like that. And he started the first International Fly Tying Symposium in 1994 at the Seven Springs Mountain Resort. And I came and spoke at that and tied flies at that, as did a number of other people that have since become widely known internationally. One of them was Theo Bacalar, the guy who brought gold beads to the United States. He first introduced those at that show, which was very interesting.
Wow.
Well, then Chuck produced in association with another person, a business partner, who at that time ran a fly fishing bookstore, and they produced a show similar to the ones that they do now here, but it wasn't widespread as it is now. At that time, there was another company called International Sportsman's Exposition that had most of the big fly fishing shows around the United States. That was sold, and the people that bought it decided to not focus on fly fishing, but to focus more on gear fishing and hunting and boats. And so that gave Chuck an opportunity to do the things he needed to do to produce this show, he does 7 of them now across the United States. His son is the president, and Chuck is the chairman of the board, if you want. But Chuck founded the shows, and like I said, in 1994, and he does 7 of them around the United States. One is in Denver, one is in Marlborough, Massachusetts, one's in Edison, New Jersey, one is in Linwood, which is right near Seattle, One is in Pleasanton, which is at basically San Francisco, and then, of course, one in Atlanta, and then this show also here in Lancaster. And they focus totally on fly fishing. It's drawn a tremendous amount of support from the fly fishing community because it is so focused on just fly fishing. You come here, there is nothing except the fly fishing. Yeah, there's some boats, but they're fly fishing boats, and they're designed and specifically tailored for fly fishing. Well, Chuck and I got to know each other, like I say, because of that first association. And over the years, we've done things together and fished together. Most often when I fish with Chuck, it's before the International Fly Tying Symposium, which he always has in November. And I go back and stay for a week, and then we go fishing for stripers and blues. But we've done other kinds of things together, too. And Chuck is a superb fly tier, really superb fly tier. And so we've tied flies together and done other sorts of things together. And we talk on the phone, every couple of weeks at least.
How does your relationships with fly fishing interact with your friendships? I mean, because it's a sport where you just build these lifelong bonds with people and you go fish together.
Sure. Well, friendship's an interesting kind of thing. It has to be based on something that you share together as individuals. So, if you're not a friend with your wife, you're not really married. So you need to share common things. Yeah, you can have different interests. That's fine. But you need to have some commonality in the way you look at life and the way you approach life. So, Nancy and I both fly fish. We both hunt. We both enjoy the outdoors. We both hike, all those kinds of things. But she has her own specialty, which is turning wood. She's a superb wood turner. In fact, international quality wood turner. And I have my own thing, which is doing this kind of stuff. She doesn't come to the shows simply because, number one, she can't turn wood here. and after you go to so many shows, you've been to so many shows.
Sure.
I come, obviously, to do the speaking and that sort of thing and interact with people. Well, in association with other people other than your wife, there, again, has to be sort of a commonality in things that you appreciate. And, of course, fly fishing is one of those kind of things that seems to draw people together because fly fishing, other than outside of the fact that, you're catching fish, is different than gear fishing because it requires you to understand a lot more about the ecology of the organisms. And that means the ecology of the trout and the ecology of the food organisms and the ecology of the ecosystem in which you're fishing. So there's a different attitude and a different way of looking at it. And fly fishing, for some reason, has gotten a hold of catch and release as their mantra, I guess, although gear fishermen can do the same kind of thing. And it was not started as a fly fishing technique. It was originally started in the state of Michigan in 1956 as a way of saving money. They didn't have enough money to plant trout, so they said catch and release only on these streams. And everybody went like, oh, no, can't kill any fish. Then they went there and caught all these big fish, and they went like, I like catching big fish. I like this a whole lot better, even though they may have been using gear in those days. But fly fishing has gotten a hold of it for several reasons, one of which is we typically use single-point hooks. They're typically small. It's easy to break the barbs down on them. And if we do, it gives us an opportunity to catch more fish and bigger fish. And I think the real joy in fly fishing is not killing a bunch of fish and taking them home. The real joy in fly fishing is to see the fish take something that you've tied yourself or imitations that you know about that or relate to what it is the fish is feeding on specifically. And as a consequence, there's a sort of a relationship in fly fishing. Somebody once said, Lou Jewett, in fact, who was then the president of the project, maybe I should say it this another way. I think he was called the director of the fly fishing project at 3M. They had just bought Scientific Anglers. And in 3M, unless it makes $100 million, it's a project. So it was a project. And Lou Jewett once said, there's no strangers in fly fishing, only friends that haven't met. And that's basically the way it is, because there's a certain commonality there in the way in which we approach fishing, the way we see life, the way we see the out-of-doors and all those things. And I think that just makes people link together better.
So it's easy to have those
friendships. It's easy to have those kind of friendships, yeah. It is.
And you go on these destination trips or you spend a day in the water with somebody, have lunch, break bread.
Sure. Enjoy times together and have a really good time, yeah.
Well, great. Just a couple more questions, Gary. If I or somebody would say, even when you're thinking about going to New Zealand, and sometimes you talk to your guide or your outfitter and they say, hey, you need to be prepared to be able to cast on a specific spot. If you miss a spot or you spook the fish, you're not going to get a second chance.
Absolutely.
So when you consider trying to improve one's casting, obviously you should practice, but you want to make sure you're practicing properly.
That's correct.
What would you say to a listener who says, I want to improve my casting? What would be some strategies to improve one's casting?
Okay, aside from the reading of books and the viewing of DVDs, all of which are, there's a lot of them, good ones out right now. And as we were discussing earlier before we started the podcast, Jason has just released a new book called Single Hand Fly Casting. And I told him, sort of jokingly, but not really, in a way, it's a National Geographic of fly casting. It has over 400 line drawings in it of Jason actually casting, and they're actually taken from high-speed videography of him casting. So they're exactly the way he casts. And everyone's illustrated. All you have to do is look at the pictures and you can learn how to cast really well.
Mm-hmm.
But practice is the key. And you never practice when you go fishing, because when you're fishing, you're not paying attention to what the rod's doing. You're just paying attention to catching fish. So number one, practice. Practice away from the river in a place where you can do it without having to concentrate on catching fish, and you can focus on practice. Second thing about practice is if you practice wrong, all it makes you is perfectly wrong. So you need to practice correctly. Practice actually means being corrected so that the steps that you're executing are the right steps, not the wrong steps, which means that you have to either have somebody else to help you out, or you've really got to focus on what you're doing. The third trick is don't use the fly rod. Do it without the fly rod and pantomime method, so you can do the method, move the arm very slowly through the process and learn how the arm's supposed to move correctly. If the arm moves correctly, the rod moves correctly, the line goes where it's supposed to go.
And you do this pantomime too, right? When you're casting exhibitions?
Sure. In fact, one of the things I do in demonstrations at shows like this is teach people how to do the pantomime and show them the pantomimes to learn, because once they learn to do that, they can correct bad habits easily just by doing the pantomime. I always tell people that, ask them if they'd seen the movie River Runs Through It, and they always go like, oh yeah. And I said, well, do you see that great casting? Yeah. I said, well, I taught the guy to do it when he's this tall, because I taught Jason to do it. And how did we do it? We just walked around the house karate chopping.
Mm-hmm.
Because the motion, the correct casting motion, is a karate chop motion, which the elbow rises and falls during the casting stroke. And when he picked up the fly rod, he didn't know any other motion. Trouble is, when you've learned to cast some other way and you have incorrect habits and you've built them into your muscle memory, it's very difficult to get rid of them. So doing it without the fly rod allows you to not focus on trying to cast line, but rather allows you to focus on just doing the arm motions correctly. The second thing is, if you do it with the fly rod, go very slow. Never make more than about 10 casts before you stop and evaluate what you're doing. If you do more than 10, your arm tends to get tired. So if you make about 10 casts, stop, look and see what you're doing. It really does dramatically help you to learn to understand how to cast correctly.
Do you recommend lessons or getting with somebody who's more advanced than you? I mean, are there schools?
There's so much right now in fly fishing. It's amazing. Just really a lot of stuff. And I'll just, I'll give a little commercial thing here. I did a 72-minute video called, it's a DVD actually, called The Perfect Cast 1. And it focuses specifically on the things I've been talking about, the concepts of pantomiming, the concepts of casting correctly, and it talks about the history of casting and develops casting through all of the various aspects of it. It's received some really, really great comments in the fishing industry, and it's only $15.
That's great. Yeah. And can you get that on your website, Gary?
You can get it on my website, which is just GaryBorger.com.
Great. Well, it has been an absolute pleasure to speak with you. I'll ask you one more question.
Sure.
And I love to ask this question to my guests, and I ask them, outside of fly fishing, what are you passionate about? It sounds like you have a great, you have a great wife, a great marriage. She turns wood.
She does.
She's a wood turner.
I'm called the mule. That is the guy that cuts the wood with a chainsaw and hauls it in.
Okay.
Whether it's 400 pounds or 2,000 pounds.
But what are you passionate about outside of fly fishing? Because you're very passionate about fly fishing.
I'm very passionate about my relationship with God. I'm very passionate about that, and I write about that extensively and send out weekly lessons to people all over the world. I'm also passionate about photography. To a lesser extent, my garden.
Okay.
Because I like to eat like everybody else.
And you love to keep a garden.
And living in the Pacific Northwest means that we can grow all kinds of things we could never grow in Wisconsin.
Mm.
Things that were just impossible to grow there because the growing seasons were too short. Now they're long enough and we can reestablish the gardens. And when I was a kid, we always had big gardens. I grew up, in Pennsylvania, in farm community, and you grew gardens because you needed it. And so now I have two grandchildren that are excited about digging potatoes and those sorts of things. And so it's very nice to be able to do that kind of stuff.
Where's your home now?
Our home is now in Washington State.
Washington.
In the lower part of Washington State, right on the Columbia River, basically.
Wow.
In a town called Vancouver. It's not Vancouver, British Columbia. It's Vancouver, Washington. It's just across the Columbia River from Portland, Oregon.
Well, Gary, it has been absolutely my pleasure. Thank you so much for being our guest today on Fly Fishing Journeys podcast. I appreciate your time. It's been great. I've learned so much myself. I actually can't wait to listen to our podcast again because I want to listen to all those great nuggets. But thank you for your time and thank you for being our guest.
My great pleasure, Rob. Thank you for inviting me to be here.
You've been listening to Fly Fishing Journeys with your host, Rob Giannino. To be notified of new episodes, subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher and follow us on Facebook. And please like and share our podcast with your friends. For past episodes or to read our journal blog posts, check out flyfishingjourneys.com. Fly fishing is a journey, and we're glad you are on this journey with us.